lot of activities going around in this committee room, and it's 5 minutes past time to start the committee, so we'll call the committee to order. And we have an announcement to make. Our normal committee committee LA is had a tragedy in her family. Rebecca, son of 27 years old, died yesterday, and she's having a very tough time, and we'll miss her, but we have Patty to take her place, and I'm sure we'll get through all the functions of the committee just fine. But I want you all to say a little prayer for her tonight sometime, and it's tough to lose a 27-year-old son not too long after she lost one of her parents.
Only child,
and it's really a tough, tough time, so she's a very important part of our team. And with that, did anybody read the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of February 8th.
Very good. Representative McFarland moves the minutes of February 8th. Are there any additions, corrections, or deletions? Seeing none, all those who approve the minutes of February 8th signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes passed. And with that, it is my pleasure to introduce the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, Commissioner Peterson. Welcome to our committee again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. With me today is Gary Hall, the Assistant Commissioner for Workers' Comp. Gary was also prior to joining the department, was a judge at the office, a workers' compensation judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. So he comes pretty well, very knowledgeable. So, Mr. Chairman, if there are any tough questions, you've got to handle them.
Okay. Well, I think I have a myth to dispel that I didn't know was the answer until a couple years ago, that work comp in Minnesota, we aren't the highest in the nation. That was always my thought. We're higher than our neighboring states for some reason. It's just kind of like our car licenses used to be. We used to have the highest car license there was around. We're right in about the middle. Is that right, Mr. Hall?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. We've been running somewhere around the middle in a whole lot of categories in work comp for some time now. I think we were 24th in the country just a couple years ago, and it moved up to 16th. But we're still out of the top 10 at least.
Okay. Would you give your name for the record, just so 100 years from now they can go to the History Center and find out you were here?
Yes, Gary Hall, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, couple things just to start out. We give, with every, well, the workers' comp system, I think I may have touched this before, the workers' compensation system was set up throughout the United States in the early 1900s. Wisconsin was the first state to have it in 1911. Minnesota adopted it in 1913. The idea behind it was to set up a no-fault system, that an injured worker would be assured of receiving payment for her or his injuries on the one hand, but to say in return for that, they gave up the right to sue in civil court. And so that's basically been the arrangement. So that was the trade-off originally set up with the workers' comp system, and that's what we have today. And every state in the union has a similar system today. First, before I get into the sort of an overview of the system, I just want to provide some cost data to you that I think is interesting. And the chairman already pointed out, and Assistant Commissioner Hall pointed out, that we're in reasonably good shape in terms of national rankings. But in terms of the cost, the total cost of workers' compensation 2008 is the last time we've had figures available, because it takes a while to assemble the figures, was about $1.4 million, or about $1.35 for $100 of payroll. So for every $100 of payroll that employers have in the state, they're paying about, and this is going to vary from employer to employer, but on an average of $1.35. That's down from $1.61 in 1997. So we are seeing that just moving down after we're seeing the effects of reforms made in 1995. So we are seeing the cost going down over time. the overall paid claim rates, that means the number of claims we've had that were actually good, that were paid by insurers, was down 38% from 1997. The point of that is we're getting fewer claims in the workers' comp system than we used to, 38% fewer than we had 10 years ago. And the nationwide, they're experiencing the same thing, that Minnesota isn't any different from any place else. And I think there's probably a couple reasons for that. One is a better awareness of safety in the workplace. Number two, probably the change in the occupational culture, with less manufacturing, less mining, less high injury-prone areas. And there may be a couple other reasons. I'm not sure what they are, but those are at least some of them.
Commissioner, Representative McFarland has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. When you go to the workers' compensation, could you just tell me, are there any employers that are exempt from paying workers' compensation? Just a basic question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McFarland, there are exceptions, and they are things like sole proprietors who don't have any employees, some small farm operations, and a few other exceptions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner. Does the state of Minnesota pay workers' comp for their employees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McFarland, the state of Minnesota is self-insured for workers' compensation, and they do cover all employees.
Commissioner.
Representative McFarland, Mr. Chairman, just to make that clear, they pay the same rates or the same benefits as everybody else does. The state pays the same identical benefits. But they are self-insured. About 25% of the total work comp costs in Minnesota are covered by self-insured people like the state. Bigger firms, 3M, other large firms are self-insured.
So, in other words, this amount of money that's taken in is basically from private employers.
Mr. Chairman, no. It's for, it also is able to account for the cost of the self-insured as well. As I said, the number of claims are down, Mr. Chairman, but if you look at the third bullet, from 1997 to 2007, the average cost per individual claim went up 34% for indemnity benefits and up 81% for medical benefits, and that averages out to 59%. So that means we're having fewer claims, but they're costing more. The medical costs are the big ones, the big increase there. People seem to be on the system longer, so they're getting indemnity costs. We say indemnity costs, that's the cash you get, the payments you get for being out. Mm-hmm. But the medical costs are higher. So people seem to be out longer, and they're getting more medical benefits, and it's costing more.
Commissioner, can you tell me, is there any segment of the medical industry that is driving the costs up more than others?
Mr. Chairman, members, we just completed a study that compared us with 16 other states done by the Workers' Compensation Research Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there's nothing in there that leaps out because so many, when you first look at it, it seems like it's certain elements are costing more, but then we're not quite sure. It does seem that we do have more, in the medical costs here, we seem to have more spinal surgeries than other states. But we're not quite sure. That's what it looks like right now. We're trying to dig more into that and find out if that's true. And there may be a couple other areas. But we just met with our researchers this morning, and they raised some questions about some of the data. So we're trying to figure that out. And once we do get a good handle on that, I'm certainly going to propose and to try to work with the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council to bring legislation to try to do something about that.
Thank you.
So I don't know if there are any other questions on this issue, but the point I really want to make was part of this longer average cost of people being out on comp longer could also reflect just an aging workforce. It takes people, as they age, it just takes people longer to heal. And we do that aging workforce, so that could be part of the problem here too. Or we're just the people that are getting comp are simply hurt more than they have more severe injuries than they did in the past.
Representative House, got a question?
Yeah, to this topic, and just to make it clear for members, think Representative Mahoney might know this, but where you have here $1.35 for $100 of payroll, what's the rate for an iron worker?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hollis, I'm not sure. I don't know.
About $10?
Could be. I'm not really sure.
Just so what, Mr. Chairman, you know, the $1.35 per $100 of payroll looks good, but if you do have to say, what is it for an iron worker? What is it for a carpenter, a steam pipe fitter? They're off the charts when you talk about $1.35.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hollis, you're actually absolutely right. There are obviously some areas, office help, they pay very little.
Yeah.
Areas like
tree trimmers.
Tree trimmers, people in nursing homes, hospital workers, some truck drivers, loggers. We've had about 20 years ago, we passed special legislation to help bring down loggers' costs because they were so high. So we do have certain areas like that, and more, more risky construction trades that are more costly. You're absolutely right. That's a good point. I'm sorry I didn't bring it up before.
Representative Leidiger has some questions. Have an interesting topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it has to do with this topic, so I kind of went forward. I don't see addressing it anywhere else. The average cost for individual claim that went up 34%. Here, the question I have is, who does the adjudication of these claims? Is that internal? You have judges internally?
Mr. Commissioner?
Representative Leidiger, Mr. Chairman, yes. I'll get to that in a minute, how we adjudicate the claims, how that's done. But they are done by, about 20% of the claims are in dispute, and we try to resolve as many as possible at the department. When they're not able to be resolved, they go over to the Office of Administrative Hearings with our judges.
Okay.
Like Assistant Commissioner Hall used to be, and they have actual trials and decide the cases. And actually, Tim Mahoney, the chief assistant administrative law judge for workers' comp, is in the audience today, so you can grab him afterwards if you're dissatisfied with their work.
Mr. Chairman, can I throw out just one little thing? Is it fair to say that you have complete control over this kind of an increase? Would you have somewhat control if you have control of the judges? I just throwing that out there.
Mr. Chairman, the judges are guided by the law. They have to interpret the law. I mean, they can't go outside the law. So, in that sense, the legislature has control. The department, we try to help administer the system, administer the dispute resolution things, but the commissioner or her or his staff, they can't decide cases. These are disputes between employers, insurers, and the employee.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to tip my hand here. I had a case 2 years ago. One of my employees that went through and ended up with like a $40,000 settlement, of which, in my humble opinion, as the supervisor, the owner, was way out of bounds. It's just so I want to let you know I got a little experience with that. That's all. That's where I'm coming from. And then to hear that, I see these numbers, and it just bothers me a little bit. That's all.
Well, I got to give my personal experience, because I was on the Work Comp Advisory Council, and we have Andrea here that is the new appointee to that council. So you can bring any questions you have to her, and she'll bring them up.
All right.
I really believe that the judges were very paid attention to be very impartial, and I think, in my opinion, they did a fairly good job of that. But I'm sure something could fall through the cracks, and I'm not going to say no, but in my opinion, they did a very good job. I've got to take my hat off to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, if I could add a little something.
Fine.
We get complaints from employers a lot of times about the amounts of settlements. But what happens is when you purchase a workers' compensation insurance policy, the owner gives up his right to have any say in the settlement in most cases. Mm-hmm. The insurance company gets to make that decision, and they do it on, you know, more of a global basis than they than looking at individual employers.
You're done?
Well, I could go on and on. I could talk about this. I could blow this out of the water, but I want to keep the personal thing aside. But yeah, the employers can get pretty angry when it's taken out of their hands and puts in the lawyer's hands, and really you end up not having any say-so. And then, of course, the employers end up paying for it, because if it's adjudicated one way, your rights are through the roof. And so this is important what you do, and that you do it fairly. I'm glad I'm now able to look at this. So.
Well, I as a former employer also, I have a little different spin on what happened. I had an injured worker that was injured. The insurance company was pretty ruthless, and he didn't get any benefits. And the reason I bought, I thought, workman's compensation insurance was to take care of my employees when they got injured. And this guy got work comp disability or SSI disability from the federal government, and he still didn't have the lawyers get done giving him anything for being injured for 6 years. So I really think it can go both ways. And Representative Howells, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been waiting 12 and a half years for him to get here to be on this committee. But Representative Leidiger, you touched on something about the rates and things. Now, I personally experienced a work injury 13 and a half years ago, and my employer wasn't opposed to the injury whatsoever. You guys weren't, but the insurance company from Iowa was having conniption fits. So I went to see their doctor. I have two herniated discs and one ruptured disc in my back. He told me to stand on my toes. I could. It hurt. And in his report, he said, this person drinks too much coffee. So I went before an administrative law judge, but I don't know that it was with your agency. I thought this was an independent law judge, and it was up in Park Rapids. I didn't hire an attorney. The thing is, I didn't go away. I was persistent. I kept pushing. The insurance company kept trying to keep it away from an administrative law judge. And I think that's where the rates start going up, because these insurance companies, they're working this system. Anyway, in the end, the judge said, this man is injured, period. And but I don't remember you guys ever being involved with something like that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howells, it probably was a judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings who drove up to Park Rapids and heard the case that day. That's what I'm assuming happened. That's the judges travel all the state. Our Office of Administrative Hearings, the judges there, they work very hard. They try to cover the state as well as they can, and try to have as many hearings in greater Minnesota as they can. So I'm assuming that's what happened.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, his administrative law judge did an excellent job.
Well, members, I just want to tell you one thing. The assistant commissioner and the commissioner would be glad to go to your office to answer individual questions. We have a full deal with macro and neighborhood development centers, so we got to move it on a little bit, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, don't we have them under oath right now?
Mr. Chairman, members, just another little fact I'll throw out, that we have seen more disputes. In 1997, 15.4 of our cases were disputed. Now it's up to 20.6%. That's a 34% hike. Medical disputes went up 134%. And that's just a result of medical costs are going up all over. It's not just in workers' comp. It's not just in Minnesota. They are going up, and we're having more disagreements over them. It's sort of a fact of life. But because of the increase in the rate of disputes, the total number of disputes that are heard by discussed at our office and heard at the Office of Administrative Hearings are about the same, despite that drop in total claims. I don't want to dwell any more on that, but that's just sort of the situation we're dealing with. And so one of the big issues that members on the Workers' Comp Advisory Commission, like Representative Kiefer and Representative Mahoney, we'll be dealing with over the next year or two will be medical costs and dispute resolution, how to make that faster.
Thank you.
Amongst others. Just to say something about the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, it was created in 1992, and it's composed of 12 voting members. Six represent organized labor, and six represent Minnesota businesses. 10 of those people are appointed by the governor, and one each are appointed by the governor, majority, minority leaders of the Senate, and the Speaker, minority leader of the House. Two other members are the presidents of the chamber and of the state AFL-CIO. And basically what we do is if anybody wants to pass, has some ideas for workers' comp legislation, they take it before the advisory committee, it's discussed there, and they recommend passing it, it comes to the legislature. If not, the practice in the legislature has been not to take them up. And I'll tell you, I was a commissioner of this department 20 years ago, and I think the present system is much better. Workers' compensation used to be a very contentious issue in the legislature, taking up a lot of time of members. The new system, I think, works, is a more streamlined system, and sort of serves as a check on legislation that may not be able to pass, but just occupy a lot of your time. But that, of course, is up to the members of the legislature how you want to proceed on that, but that's been the practice, and I think it's been pretty successful. The system is paid for by assessments on insurers and self-insurers. The assessment pays for our department's workers' compensation division, the workers' compensation division of the Office of Administrative Hearings, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and parts of Minnesota OSHA, and parts of the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce is a fraud unit that does some investigations in workers' comp, and that pays for that. It also pays for supplementary and second injury benefits. Those are two programs that were eliminated in the 1990s, but we're phasing them out by, I think they'll be completely gone by 2050, but they're getting smaller every year. And also for uninsured claims and vocational rehabilitation services for claims have been denied. The assessment is based on a formula I think everybody agrees. I'm not going to go into details of what that is. Then in terms of the way, I'll try to go through the system as quickly as you can, Mr. Chairman. I know you're in a hurry to get the other people, so I'll try to cover it as quickly as possible. And if I go too long, please tell me to wrap it up.
I'm sure you will. Very important subject.
Every employer in the state, as Representative McFarland asked earlier, must purchase a workers' compensation insurance policy from a private insurance company or qualify as a self-insured entity. Costs of all workers' compensation benefits as well as the cost of administering the system are covered by those policy premiums. Then when an employee sustains an injury, the employer submits a first report of injury to its insurer, and then if the injury requires them being out of work for at least 3 days or requires medical treatment, they must file the form with the Department of Labor and Industry. So if not more than 3 days or you got a medical injury, they got to send it in to us. So we get most of them. Then the insurance company usually, as Assistant Commissioner Hall was pointing out, they investigate the claim and determine whether the liability will be accepted. They'll try to determine whether or not it's actually a work-related injury or not. If it's not, or they think that the injury was occurred someplace else, they'll deny it and say we're not going to pay for it. If they do think, but then if the employee believes that it was a work-related injury, the employees can certainly challenge it in the system. So if it's turned down, the employee can challenge it, and they move ahead. If a claim is accepted by the insurer, the employee is entitled to various wage loss benefits. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I know, do you have the percentage of claims, substantial claims, I'll kind of limit it, that are challenged by the insurance companies? I mean, from all the calls I get at my office, I would suspect it's 100% challenged by the insurance companies.
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chairman, about 20% are challenged. Most of them are accepted. However, the ones that are more serious, they do challenge the some medical stuff. But overall, it's about 20% dispute rate. But that doesn't tell you, that figure does not go into the size of the disputes. I expect those are more costly, we have more disputes, those are less costly, if I have fewer disputes.
Thank you.
You're entitled, if you're hurt, you're entitled to wage loss benefits, medical services, vocational rehabilitation benefits, and, well, the wage loss benefits. Now, the wage loss benefits, there are four categories. Three categories. You get a temporary total. That's, you're hurt and you can't work. You break a leg. But you're not permanently hurt, but it's a temporary, but you're totally, you can't go to work. That's one. You get complete wage loss until you're recovered. A temporary partial disability means you got an injury that you can go back, that you're only partially hurt. Maybe you hurt one arm, but you can do some stuff at work, but you can still go back to work, but you still can't do everything at work. So you get some benefits from there. Then the permanent total is you're out for good. You can't work. A very serious injury for one reason or another. Then the ones that are the most common are called permanent partial disability benefits. And those are ones that an individual is hurt, is a partial disability, but it's hurt on a permanent basis. And for example, you have a back injury that's not a, doesn't completely render you incapable of working, but you may not be able to go back to your old job or do the work you once did. And those are often, I think that may have been the situation your employee was in that they settled for. You often, for one reason or another, they're permanently hurt, but it doesn't completely incapacitate them.
Representative Leidiger has a question.
I actually have a question. I'm going to ask the isolated question first, and then kind of we can dialogue just briefly on what you were talking about. Where in the process do you go back and look at previous claims? And is it in the process? In my case, the guy had come before this four times. We were the fourth time, and it was in and I believe that there was fraud involved, this being his fourth time, and it was just totally taken out of the hands of the employer, and it was my insurance company's lawyer that was handling it, and it was as though they're going back and forth and getting, you know, not even looking at the past history of this particular employee, and in fact adjudicating it without any without recognizing it that there were past claims that he had done, and when we tried to interject that history when we found out, and also more details about the particular incident, which it all pointed towards possible fraud, none of that was taken into consideration. It got into where the two lawyers were going back and forth.
Assistant Commissioner Hall may add a few things, but in this case, that's insurance company's call. I would just, from your version of it, it seems to me that your insurance company should have listened to you and taken steps that they didn't take.
Well, where's the Mr. Chairman, may I just ask this? Where's the incentive for the insurance company to do that? Because the lawyers get paid on handling these cases and moving them forward.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger, in the cases that we saw over at the Office of Administrative Hearings, it's the formal trial proceeding. The attorneys on both sides are doing a lot of discovery. The defense attorneys, in my experience, have always known about previous injuries. They raise the issue of fraud a number of times. I've had it in my court. It's a matter of evidence and proof. I mean, and I think that they do raise it, you know, not always successfully, but there is a statute in there that allows for full reimbursement if there's a determination of fraud. And it is part of the discovery process. They get all the records from all the old injuries.
They get them.
Moving ahead, for medical care, all reasonable and necessary medical care is available to cure or relieve the disability. You're also entitled to rehabilitation services under Minnesota law. Before I get into the dispute resolution, one of the things that happens that we send out to every injured employer that we get a first report of injury from, we send out an employee's guide to the Minnesota Workers' Compensation System and let those individuals know what's going on. I think we've passed it out to all of you. We also, on our website, we do have, it's a 25-page thing that you can look for employers. It's just called Training for Employers. That kind of also goes to the workers' compensation system and how it works. And we've talked about sending something out to all employees, but we're assuming that most employers do have access to the internet, and also their insurance company should be helping them try and describe how the system works. But we do want to make sure everybody understands the system and how the disputes work and what people are entitled to. So we do try to do that. We'll assume for a moment the individual's claim is turned down. The insurance company says, based on their conversations with the employer, comes back and says, we deny it. So then if the claim benefit is denied by an insurer, the employee may challenge that denial. What we do at the Department of Labor and Industry, we try to provide services to help people avoid litigation they don't need to. That if it's, particularly if it's a smaller claim, so they don't have to go through the expense of having a lawyer and taking the extended period of time you may have to do for litigation, for the discovery process and that sort of thing. So a party can be used as an attorney if they want to, or as Representative Howes did in his case, you don't have to use an attorney. And if you're, you don't have to use them. Sometimes it's best, depends on your case, what situation is, and depends on your own abilities. But the alternatives we use are, first would be early assistance intervention. We just simply call up the parties and see what can be worked out. Try to find out what's going on here. What's a dispute? Talking to both parties and see if there's an obvious place, a meeting of the minds that could occur that hasn't been explored yet. The next one is called certification of disputes. That's basically saying there is a legitimate difference of opinions here, that these two are, there are two different ways of seeing this issue, and there's a disagreement. So you certainly can entitled to get a lawyer if you want and move ahead. We have administrative conferences, which I'll go through in a minute, and expedited rehab conferences, and then mediation. The early assistance and intervention is just called for by the law that says we need to make efforts to settle problems of employees and employers by contacting third parties on behalf of employers and employees and using our department's persuasion to settle issues quickly and cooperatively. We try to work things out whenever we can. The certification of disputes, that's basically we're saying there is a legitimate disagreement here. Attorney fees can't be charged until there is a certification of dispute. I don't think I'll go in much more. Administrative conferences, we have those for at the department for medical and rehab issues. And the purpose there is simply to try, we know there's a dispute, so we try to bring the two parties together. These are often by phone, sometimes in person, and try to work things out and see if we can actually make them come to a meeting of minds. If agreement isn't possible, then the mediator issues a decision in order which can be appealed. We say this is what we think it should be, but they can appeal that. And then they can appeal that to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Then we also have expedited rehab conferences. Rehab is an interesting issue because you want an injured worker to get back to work as quickly as possible and to provide the type of services that are going to help her or him get back to work. If there are ways that they could do other jobs, or if they're just even physical exercises or whatever. We want these people to get back to work as quickly as possible. And so in Minnesota, we're more successful than other places have been just because we have that emphasis on rehab. But then there we have to conference within 20 days of a request to try to get those people back, get something done in the rehab as quickly as possible. Without having a minister, we can do... These are mediations, and we have tried to really increase the number five, their mediations. We try to increase those and encourage them. We now have mostly lawyer mediators, and they're all almost like judges trying to mediate problems. We've more than doubled that in the last few years. The agreement is reached for a mediator. The mediator arranges for a mediation resolution award to be signed, awarded, and filed. And that's mediation's the best way of solving these issues. We can just get people to agree on it. However, oftentimes they don't. That's when they're sent, if we can't solve the problems, they're sent over to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and then it becomes more like a trial. The parties are entitled to discovery to find out what the positions, what the facts are that led the other side to their conclusions, find out why the insurance company is turning them down or why the employee, is the injured worker, is asking for benefits. So that takes longer. It's just going to take longer for discovery. And that's where we start running into some of the more, and it's legitimate too, just more the time delays, just because it takes time for people to gather all the information.
Commissioner, I think Representative Clark has a question.
Well, I was actually waiting. Were you just about done? I thought you were just about completed. Okay, well, here's what the question is. I recently was approached by someone and became aware of an issue of a person who had a serious allergic reaction to something on the job and was fired because he couldn't continue to work there. How long a time, this has happened about 6 months ago, how long a time frame, he didn't know his rights. He happens to be English-speaking, but with some difficulty, happens to be a Hmong person who, I doubt at the workplace, there was a poster in Hmong that said what his rights were, although maybe we do have those posted at the workplaces if there are multicultural workers there. Two things. Do we have those kinds of signs available in different languages for people, especially in where there's a lot of industries where there might be a lot of non-English-speaking people or not English as their first language, people working? And secondly, what is the length of period after someone is fired for some, you know, for a situation like this that they can go back and raise an issue and try to get workers' compensation? He's some very serious health problems as a result of this allergic response.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, in answer to your first question, we do have multi-language posters. I'm not sure if Hmong is one of them. I assume it is. It is. Okay. We do have it in Hmong. In answer to your second question, the notice provisions for filing work comp claim are most closely connected to when the employee has noticed that he has an injury and that it's compensable. In the case of a language barrier, I think there's a very good argument that he could make the claim even after the statutory time period. It has to do when he became aware of the compensability of a condition that may be work related.
And Mr. Chairman, what is the statutory time limit?
There are several of them. It's in chapter 176.141. And I can't remember the other citation off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to get back to you with that information.
All right, thank you. Yeah.
As I was saying, the disputes are then sent over to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and then at the Office of Administrative Hearings, they try to do a settlement conference, try to settle the issue before they have to go to a hearing. If that doesn't happen, they do have a hearing, and they fight it out. Now, it's at this stage where often you have the settlements. Once the two sides get more information, they do some discovery, get more information as to what the other side has, what the basis for the arguments are, then they maybe educate, both sides be educated enough to try to make a settlement. And the reason, there are a variety of reasons why people enter into settlements. One, you don't want to risk going to trial because you think you may lose more. Another reason may be in terms that an individual worker needs the money now and can't wait for a trial that may be several months off. Or an insurance company simply wants to get rid of a case. It's just got too many, it's got its own reasons. So there are a variety of reasons that, and they may not be the same reason for every case either. But settlements are necessary for the system. If we didn't have settlements, the system, just like in the criminal system, if we didn't have settlements or plea bargains in the criminal system, or didn't have settlements in the workers' comp system, it would never get any done. You know, most contested cases are settled. If parties are dissatisfied with the results of the compensation judge, they can appeal to the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and they're still dissatisfied, they can ask the State Supreme Court to hear their case. That apparently completes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the Commissioner or the Assistant Commissioner? I do want to tell you one thing that's been my experience. If you do have questions from your constituents, please don't hesitate to call John Rutkowski and he'll get you to the right place.
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. John Rutkowski is here today. He'll get back to you right away, or contact me or contact Assistant Commissioner Hall if you can't get hold of him. We'll get back to you right away. We understand you do get questions on this. Even for your new members, if you haven't got questions yet, you will get them. But even, and you may not have any idea how to deal with them. And we'll try to help you out as much as possible and as quickly as possible.
Is there any questions from the audience? Come on down, and we'd love to hear you. Ron, you want to get him a chair? Okay. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Yes, I will, sir. My name is Troy Parker. I had a case with workers' comp, and it was settled three times on three different occasions because of a knee injury. And then after the doctor ruled that this injury was a permanent injury, I was then told that I had to go through the whole procedure over again because a settlement didn't necessarily mean that they agreed and took responsibility for the injury. Well, this information is not relayed to citizens of Minnesota. So in my knowledge of what I thought was the actual law, I thought settlements and them accepting responsibility and paying for all the surgeries and lost time meant that they were accepting the responsibility that this injury was their responsibility to me. But once it became a permanent injury, they then had the ability to deny the whole claim. And I don't think that has been addressed at any of these hearings. And so I just want to know the commissioner's opinion or stance on that.
Well, there certainly is the proper forum for that is in the Work Comp Advisory Council meetings. However, since we have the experts right here, I'm sure they might give you a little indications of where you could, how you can get relief. I know they probably have to research your case, but.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mr. Parker, I don't know enough about it from what I've just heard here, but it sounds like you had a settlement and that you had some claim for benefits after the settlement that the insurance company denied. Was it medical benefits? Or?
Well, and I won't keep going back. I'm sorry. But mine is way years past. But what I'm saying is, as a constituent or a worker, you should have the right to know that this settlement does not mean that the employer took responsibility, because if they can then come back years later and say, no, we just gave you money just on the goodwill of our organization and we didn't really accept responsibility for this injury, that's really not the way I perceived it. That's all I was saying.
Commissioner, members, Mr. Parker, the judges do approve the settlements. What hopefully that the members, the parties, the lawyers, and the other parties to these systems can do a better job of informing people. We'll try to take a look at that and see if it's been a recurring problem to make sure that people do understand the settlements they're entering into.
Yeah.
There's a chain that's happened.
Mr. Parker, you might want to get their card and give them your phone number so they can call you and tell you what they have determined. Anything else from the audience? Well, thank you very much. We appreciated your very informative presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
And next we have an overview of the Minnesota Association of Rehabilitation Organizations. Please come forward. Did you get that stuff?
Yeah.
Give it to Johnny Rocket.
Brian.
Welcome to the committee. Would you, as you speak, would you give your name for the record?
My name is Clayton Lind, and I work for the Occupational Development Center, and I am also the president of MACRO. And I'll be starting out with just a brief overview of MACRO and the Extended Employment Program. MACRO is the Minnesota Association of Community Rehabilitation Organizations, and we were established in 1974. The purpose of our organization is to promote and assist in the ongoing development of habilitation, rehabilitation, and employment programs for the disabled individuals. We do this through promoting unity amongst our organizations, promoting standards, sharing ideas and experience, and coordinating with other organizations. Throughout Minnesota, there's currently 28 community rehab providers, and 23 of those organizations belong to MACRO. One of the key, well, probably the most key program that we deal with is the extended employment program and the long-term job supports for individuals with disabilities that are provided through that program. This program was originally established in the 60s and is a performance-based system, which means that the providers only receive payment when the clients are actually working. This program is administered by the State Vocational Rehabilitation Services Agency with Indeed. And VR contacts directly with each of our organizations to provide these services. Some of the services that we provide are working with the individual clients to train them on specific job tasks, dealing with schedule changes, adjusting to new work environments, working with them so that they can advance in their careers, behavior management issues, job carving, and then we do a lot of work with the individual businesses that they're employed at. One thing under this program that we really wanted to point out is this program allows the clients to receive these services at no cost to themselves, and that the wages that these people receive are actually paid for by the individual businesses that they work for. None of it, state funding through this program goes to the wages of these clients. Last year, over 5,400 clients were served in this program, and they had wages over $25 million. The extended employment program is really the backbone, as I said, for providing these services, but really it only provides a small portion of the overall costs, and we need to leverage for every dollar the state provides to us an additional $4 to serve our clients. This program, at first glance, sometimes people say that or feel that this is just another social services program, but this is a real jobs related program. It's about hardworking individuals who are very loyal to their businesses and are maybe more relying on their specific jobs that they have than most people, because if for some reason they do lose their jobs, it's going to be very, very difficult for them to find another position. Or there might not even be funding available for us or the other organizations to be able to work with them to find those positions.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Brian Benchoof. I am the CEO of MRCI WorkSource in Mankato, Minnesota. I want to talk a little bit about the cost effectiveness and how the funding is actually given to us as organizations. If you look in the handout you had under funding, that's where I'm going to be talking from. As Clayton mentioned, this is a jobs program. And we feel as providers of services to people with disabilities that it is a very cost-effective and efficient program based on the idea that we are paid for outcomes. We are paid, we receive our funding when our clients are working. If our clients aren't working, we don't get paid. The extended employment funding comes to us to provide supports to people who we've already helped find a job. So once somebody is employed in our communities, this funding provides that staffing support for them to keep their job and to advance. We work with our people once they're employed to find ways to move up in their employment as well as to maintain their employment. So these people are working with private employers. They've been hired in the job force. They're paid by the employer at prevailing wages for the job that they're working in. And we're kind of the people that stand behind them with staff support to maintain their jobs and keep their jobs. And sometimes they need that support in cases to maintain that employment. We also provide support to the employers through training, how to work with a disability, and to work through problems that may come up on the job to help that person maintain their employment. If you look at the funding source, expenditures, our funding comes from two sources, the general fund and workforce development funds. And you can see a three-year history there of those dollars. We've also included a chart that shows a line graph of our funding versus inflation over the last number of years. And you can see the funding has remained fairly flat in comparison to inflation. Clayton touched on the fact that these dollars leverage other dollars for us. They leverage private dollars and wages that employers pay to our clients. We also use these funds to leverage other dollars, private and public, to cover the costs of providing these supports. So these dollars do not fully fund the services that we provide to these people. Finally, at the bottom, you'll see a chart, again, of number of people that we work with, the hours that are generated in work, and the wages that the people earn. So you can see it's a very productive source of funding for the people that we work with. It's also a very critical piece of funding because, as we've mentioned, many of these people would not succeed or continue to succeed in their employment without this level of support. So.
Chairman Gunther, representatives. My name is Karen Johnston, and I'm the Executive Director of Tasks Unlimited in Minneapolis. And Tasks provides supported housing and employment to people with serious and persistent mental illness. And I'm here today to tell you about a story about one of the clients that we serve. And his picture here is on the booklet. He's the third from the left here. And that's Kyle. And as a young man, Kyle was a sports star in high school, but he didn't know he had a mental illness. He had no clue what was going on with him. He self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. He became addicted, and he ended up with two children that he could not support. He moved from place to place. He was homeless, often landing in treatment centers, in the psych units of hospitals, jail, group homes, halfway houses, all at public expense. When he did have a job, he couldn't keep it because the symptoms of his mental illness prohibited him from working. Kyle hit bottom, and at one of his halfway houses, he heard about Tasks Unlimited, and after a long wait, he was accepted into Tasks Unlimited training program. When he started the Lodge training program, he was determined to turn his life around, but he soon realized that mental health recovery takes a long time, and it was with that staff support that the extended employment dollars helped pay for that he was able to turn his life around. Because mental illness is just that. It's serious and it's persistent. It doesn't go away. So staff helped him work on the necessary skills to maintain long-term employment and long-term housing. We helped him on basic independent living skills. We helped him learn job skills, what to dress, what to say, what to wear, how to behave. And he learned those proper job skills. He learned how to manage his medications and his mental illness. And after graduating from the training program, he went into one of our lodges where he received a little further support. And the extended employment dollars helps us help Kyle be successful because he couldn't do it with his mental illness without that help. Working is normal for most of us, but most of us don't hear voices on a regular basis. We're not scared that someone's following us. And we don't think we're seeing things that aren't there. Kyle and others like him need the support by the staff to help him learn how to manage those kinds of symptoms. And he's also to stay out of the hospital. We all know that the placements in psychiatric hospitals are hugely expensive. And because of extended employment, he hasn't been in the hospital since he's entered tasks, and he is successful by, I believe, anyone's standards. He's making almost $13.50 an hour, paid for by the employer. He works full-time on a janitorial contract that Tasks manages. He lives now independently with a little support by Tasks staff. He pays rent, and he's paying child support, and he's seeking custody of his two children. Also a savings to the public. And without these extended employment dollars, none of this would be possible. Working does work. People want to work. But people with mental illness and other disabilities need that little bit of extra help in order to be successful on the job. Tasks clients last year earned over $3 million, and they paid taxes on those dollars. Many of our clients give up their Social Security disability and other disability checks because they don't need them any longer once they get and maintain these jobs. I regularly give 10, 15, 20-year working awards to people that were in state hospitals diagnosed mentally ill and dangerous and are now living, working members of our community. And they don't go back to the hospital because they have this support. They would be back in the hospital if they did not. We have over a 3-year waiting list for people waiting to get in, like Kyle, to get their chance to get a job with a little support. And with that, they're able to keep it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, my name is Walter Wierenka. I am a employment specialist for LifeTrack Resources. I've been privileged to work there for 14 years as of this month, so that's very exciting to me. And I'm also an individual with a disability who is working along with other individuals with disabilities to help them maintain and to keep employment. Last year, 2010, LifeTrack, we worked with over 100 people in this area. As you can hear, and as what has been shared with, it's working is vitally important, as we all know. And it brings money back to the tax basin, which is something we're looking for with all of our budget situations. And also, it's been shown many, many times that individuals with disabilities are phenomenal consumer spenders. And if you want proof of that, I'll bring my wife in and she'll testify to that too. I get money, we spend it. But getting to work and being able to work does take some relief off the public support money, assistant money that is out there, and helps the individual feel fully participant in our society. One of the areas that we really are emphasizing and working on within this program now is not only just helping individuals to maintain, but to advance in their work. And I have two little quick snapshots I'd like to share with you. My first client that I work with is working for Ramsey County and has been there now for 2 years. Recently, we meet every other twice a month, and recently he was sharing with me that he was feeling overwhelmed. They kept piling on more work, more work, more work. And in the past, on all his other old jobs, he would just get up and walk away, just leave it. But we sat down and we went through, and I asked him to go through and look at all that's been going on. What was he supposed to do? What have they been giving him? He came back a couple weeks later with a job description over 20 pages long of what he all had to do. And he took this to his immediate supervisor. It went up through the chain of commands. What has happened through this whole process of what he came together with us working together and going to the proper people, as Ramsey County comes in touch with their budget, they have promised him that they will be moving him into a different classification, different grade, and he will be getting a raise and having more responsibility legitimately given to him by him advocating and speaking up for himself. He had major mental health barriers that would have stopped him otherwise from pursuing this if the support from us was not there. The second snapshot is a gentleman I've been working with who has been working for a group home for a year. And recently, his supervisor decided to move on and progress into a different job totally outside of the group home. But before she left, she recommended him to take the supervisory position for that particular home. He was very distraught by it. He really wanted to do it, but with his mental health issues, OCD issues, and other disabilities that would come into play, he wasn't sure if he could do it. We went through a pros and con. We sat down and looked at all the pluses, minuses, and what could get in possibly in his way. Through this, he decided he'd go forth with the interview. He went to the interview. They offered him the job, and we are now working through a few issues here and there, but he's been doing this for now about 6 months as the new manager of that group home and is very excited about where he is and what he is doing. This extended employment program is very beneficial to Minnesota businesses and to individuals in this state with disabilities. It makes us feel complete and fully participants in our society. For me, the greatest day was when I was able 14 years ago being hired by LifeTrack to get off of Social Security. It took me a long time to do that, but I've never looked back, and I've been very pleased to be totally independent on my own. And that's what I feel this service provides to our individuals. Current workforce studies show, as you all are very much aware of, that our workforce is going to be changing immensely. We, as a group with disabilities, want to be a part of that. We have been trying to be a part of it. We have been a part of it in many ways, but there's a lot more yet to do and a lot more people yet to support and serve. I would like to leave you with a final thought and a final example of how important I really feel, and I think it really is to all of us. I would like you to think about when you meet somebody new and you go up to them and you extend your hand and you say, hi, I'm so-and-so and I'm so-and-so. What's the next question you inevitably ask somebody? What do you do for a living? And now with this program, we're able to help folks stay on the job and advance in the job so with pride they can say, I do such and such, or I'm doing this. But there's still a lot more who can use and can need the support and help that we provide to help everyone be able to stand up and say, I have a job and I do this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for anybody who can answer it. First of all, I commend you for the work that you're doing. I did go visit one of the employment sites in my area, and I'm just so proud of the work they're doing. What I'm wondering is this: with this downturn in the economy, are you finding it harder to find employers to employ your clients?
Mr. Chair and Representative McFarland, yes, just as any other business, we are dealing with the downturn in the economy quite a bit. It's significantly impacted us over the last couple of years. Just as other employers, other businesses are laying off people, we're trying to get out there and get people with disabilities jobs, and it's become harder and harder and harder as more and more people become unemployed. Also, a lot of our organizations do a lot of production work ourselves in our facilities, and a lot of those businesses can no longer subcontract with us, so there's even less work for the people that are working in our organizations. Does anybody else have anything to add?
I'll just add to that it's really challenged us to work a little bit harder and to really sell the value of what we do to those employers, and sometimes even in tough times that will, you know, help us move people into jobs. So we just have to try a little more. So,
and we're a little unique. We run our own janitorial business and contract with county, state, and federal agencies cleaning buildings. And they all have the same pressures with the cutbacks. So hours have been cut, but we still do what we can.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gentleman from Mankato.
Yes.
If you could work me through, I'm just curious. I like to see when we can have programs actually leverage funds to get, you know, reward good behavior like employment. How does the money work? Because you said we don't get paid unless our people are employed and working and productive. How does that cost structure work? Like, how much do you get? You get paid by the hour that it's worked, or by the day, or by the person? I would just be curious to help understand that.
That's a very good question. We are paid by the hour of work that is produced by the client, the individual with a disability. So we have a contract with the state to provide so many hours of work support to people based on an hourly rate that is determined by our contract. So for every hour of employment by a person, we get paid. We use that money then to pay our staff that provide that support. As I mentioned earlier, that level of funding doesn't cover all of our costs, but it enables us to leverage other dollars as well that we can bring in to do that. So if we don't have people working and we just do not receive that funding, so it's in our best interest of our clients to be working very hard for them to keep them employed. So.
Just a follow-up, Mr.
Representative Stensrud.
Yeah. And just maybe, so it's a sliding scale, sounds like. So someone working for a lower wage, you get reimbursed less than if it's higher wage?
It's not necessarily tied to their wage. It's tied to the level of supports that we provide to people. So if we have somebody who is employed by an employer and we're providing that support, there's a higher tier of funding for that than if they have support from us in a less supportive situation. So there's a range of hourly rates. The highest rate that we can earn is $378 an hour. So what we're doing is drawing down our contract with the state of Minnesota to provide those services. So.
Just to follow up.
Just to clear. Okay. And $378, is that $3.78?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm
thank
sorry.
You.
$3.78 per hour that we report for work. So. Yeah.
All right.
At the lower end of that scale, if we have some individuals that are working actually at our facility, for those individuals, we only receive $1.78 per hour. And then there's a middle range where it's $3.24 an hour. Those are the individuals who are maybe working out at a local business, for example, doing janitorial services, but they're in a group of individuals working together to do the same function.
So there's an incentive for us to have our people working in the most independent scenario, which would be working with an employer and paid directly by that employer.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of all of you can answer this. Do you have a set of standards of wages? I mean, you don't send them out unless they make a minimum wage, or don't send them out unless they're making living wage with benefits.
I'll take a crack at that. I guess across the board, there is a lot of variation between the different organizations. Some of the organizations pay everybody that works out in the community at least minimum wage or above. There are some organizations, though, that still are paying on a piece rate or below minimum wage rate. But I think for the most part, everybody that's working out in the community is at minimum wage or above. And some of the folks that are working at our specific facilities, some of those individuals may be paid at a piece rate basis also based on how productive they are with their disabilities. But even in facility, a lot of those individuals are paid at minimum wage or above. Just for example, I know in our organization, we employed about 780 individuals with disabilities last year. 70% of those individuals were paid at minimum wage or above.
Mr. Chair, and sorry, I can't remember which representative it's asked the question. Mahoney. At LifeTrack, we do competitive employment out in the community. And one of the things that drives the question of the wage is what the individual who comes into us is looking for. There's a lot of variables at play with that, especially mainly their concern for health care. So many are just part-time, and there's limits by what some of the money that they get through Social Security or such might limit them to. But our average is about $9.50 an hour for all the folks placed. I've placed people all the way to $15 an hour down to $7.50 or minimum wage. It's a lot of what they want, but most of them are striving for, looking for a living wage, and eventually, as they work through it, getting off of all supports and having a higher paid wage. So it's vitally important, but it is driven a lot by the individual.
Chairman, Representative Mahoney, Pass Unlimited is a little unique because we have county, state, and federal contracts. We're mandated by those contracts to pay a certain wage based on the prevailing wage. So some of our employees are making as much as $17 an hour. And the minimum that we pay is right around $8 or $9 an hour.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So, to all of you, how many of your clients, I mean, it sounds like you can't have all of your clients do this, but do your clients actually work themselves off or out of your program? And what's the percentage of that over a year or over the lifetime of your program?
Mr. Chairman Mahoney, I don't know the percentage per se from LifeTrack being just the lowly little employment specialist, but I will just share that to me, one of the greatest compliments is the day I get the phone call where the individual says, I don't need you anymore. And I'm able to do this on my own. But I'm always quick to reassure them, saying, well, if anything does come up, don't hesitate to call back. And I really, you know, I've had some folks on my caseload who I've been providing services for 18, they've been on our books for 18 years, and I've been working with them for all 14. But it's just basically a phone call every so often saying, hey, I don't want to go to work today. And I have to talk them into going to work. And that might just be here and there. So there's varieties. But the goal, I think, for everyone that sits in my chair is they would like to eventually be able to totally get off of, be independent without our services and such. So.
Yes, I don't think that any of us have a clear picture of what percentage would be where our consumers are out there on their own, not needing our services anymore. But you need to keep in mind that these are the people with the most severe disabilities, and that in most cases, a lot of them will never be able to function at their jobs without our supports. We all have people that are become very successful and leave the programs, which is awesome. And that's what we all want to see. But we know in reality that a lot of the folks just will never be able to do that. And, you know, right now, one of the biggest issues we are dealing with, of course, is that the continuous cutbacks that are happening all across the country. It affects us greatly, too, because as Karen had mentioned, a lot of us have so many individuals looking to get these services, but we're not able to provide them because the funding isn't there, or there isn't enough jobs, you know, to place them in right now. A lot of organizations, just like Karen mentioned, we have long waiting lists waiting mm-hmm. for people. People are waiting for our services. We just can't accommodate them right now.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you. To that point, so do you send out job coaches with your clients? And who pays for their salaries?
Yes.
Mr. Benjamin.
We really develop the services that each person needs based on their individual needs, obviously. And that might vary from somebody who's with them very frequently to a minimal amount of support that may be several times a month but our goal is to do it based on what they need and to be as unobtrusive as possible. We want to help that person maintain their employment and work with that employer, but we want them to be as independent as possible. This funding pays the staff costs, part of the staff costs to do that. This funding does not pay for the wages or it really is about the support that they receive to keep their job.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just trying to separate two different issues here. I think the developmentally disabled have DTH, the day training and habilitation, but they also receive some Medicaid funding. So your programs are paid for by the general fund through DEED, and also the Workforce Development Fund of an almost equal amount, which is a tax, the tax that's levied on businesses that pay unemployment insurance. So do you receive any Medicaid match with your general fund monies or not?
No. Under this program, you cannot be funded by both the extended employment and the Medicaid funding.
Mr. Chair, and I guess what I'm getting at is the Medicaid funding is generally matched by federal dollars, whereas this is funded by the taxpayers only of Minnesota and the business owners who pay unemployment insurance. That's your only two sources of funding here. And so it's totally state.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, we do also leverage other county dollars, very minimal amount. But you're right. It's state funding. And we're serving a population of people that are not part of the day training and rehabilitation services, which generally have a higher need of staffing and more intense service area. So.
Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you for the wonderful presentation. We appreciate it very much. We all learned something.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Neighborhood Development Centers. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Tamale, and I'm the president of the Neighborhood Development Center. So thank you for having us and letting us join in the discussion about creating jobs in Minnesota, because that's why we're here today. We're passing around a two-page document that outlines some of our work, and I think we're also going to try to pass out a box of cookies, because we're kind of extended over the lunch hour here. Is that good? And these cookies are made by the Salty Tart. Michelle Gayer is sitting to my right, who is a finalist this year to be named the best baker in America by the James Beard Award. She came in the top two or three in New York City. So hopefully these cookies get you over to that global market and to the Salty Tart. The way the Neighborhood Development Center participates in the issue of creating jobs is a very cost-effective way. At about $4,600 a job, we do it through entrepreneur development, particularly in the niche of low-income entrepreneurs who are not getting a lot of support from any other type of program or organization. A number of you are small business owners yourselves, and therefore your employers, and so you can relate very well to the critical role of business training and business knowledge, as well as financing, for any startup entrepreneur and any entrepreneur trying to grow their business. And that's what we do. This is doubly important for low-income entrepreneurs who maybe don't come out of a business family or business background. I think the cookies are preempting. Take two, by the way. Take two. There's plenty of them.
I'll hold them.
We should have brought.
I don't want
to. We should have brought coffee too. We have a coffee guy. We could have brought over here. Just in a sentence or two, briefly, before I introduce the other folks up here, the Neighbor Development Center has trained thousands of low-income entrepreneurs to start their own business. They're inner-city residents, by and large. About 20% of them actually do start a business. So they figure out in a hurry that owning a business isn't for everybody, and they figure that out in our classes, and they figure it out in a much cheaper way than investing whatever savings they have in a business that doesn't work. We also, besides training, do a lot of high-touch financing of these startups with a real good repayment rate. We utilize some state money for that. We use a lot of private money for that. We also have a number of business incubators that we've developed and operate. Today we're here to ask to share our work with you, and also to ask you to consider supporting our work with $200,000 of state funding. We currently do not get state funding for our work. I am joined today up here by one of our founders, Bill Sands, and two of our entrepreneurs, Michelle Gayer from the Salty Tart Bakery. How is it so far? And Isaac
Carpenter. This doesn't look like a tart, though. This looks like a cookie.
Well, there's a whole range of products. I'm sure you can ask and hear about it. And by the way, all these entrepreneurs tend to be expansionary minded, so anybody from the East Side or anywhere else looking for a baker, looking to expand and grow, opportunities can be presented. And Isaac Carpenter, who's the owner of a great sheetrock company that we've been working with, and who's doing all the sheetrock work on our new building at University in Dale. That's four stories high. It's been going up right now. It's about to open next week, actually. But if we could start with Bill
who is the owner of Western Bank and former president of the Minnesota Banker Association. If he was here to talk a little bit about why he and his bank were involved in starting our organization 20 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee, give you a name for the record, please.
My name is Bill Sands from St. Paul, Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I work at Western Bank, which is about a mile down University Avenue West, University in Dale. For those of you who've been around here a while, or maybe you haven't been around here a while, that intersection has had a great reputation over the years for negative reasons, but we've worked real hard the last 40 years to try to improve that intersection. And the bank was founded 95 years ago, and it's always been on the corner of Dale and University. My father left employment of the state of Minnesota in 1935. He officed in this building to buy that bank, and I have the privilege and pleasure now of being one of the family shareholders, but I've been there for over 40 years, and I'm very proud of what the bank has done and the role we've played in making that a better place to live and to work, that broader community. Western Bank is a state bank, so it was chartered by the state of Minnesota, and I was president of the Minnesota Bankers back in the late 80s when the federal government passed a law that allowed national banks to have community development corporations, and this was another case where state banks had to get on board to create a parity situation. If national banks could have community development corporations, why shouldn't state banks have community development corporations? That law was passed, I think, in 88 or 89, and Western Bank was one of the first banks then to create a community development corporation. That's when we hired Mike Tamale. And at that time, we worked with strip streets like University Avenue, Rice Street, Concord Avenue to try to organize the business community to make a difference in their own economic situation, but in their neighborhood. And I think about 1992, 1993, Mike saw some research that was done that concluded that a lot of people living in impoverished neighborhoods had businesses in their garages and their homes or whatever to supplement their welfare income. They were painting cars, they were doing hair, they were doing sewing or whatever, and Mike had this vision that if we could provide training and loan funds and so forth to these people in these disadvantaged communities, would they be willing to grow their businesses and create some jobs, pay taxes, and so forth. So that was kind of the impetus to create the Neighborhood Development Center, which was so successful that we had to spin it off, and it is a separate freestanding 501c3. It raises, Mike will tell you, over $1 million a year privately and through some levels of government. But I am very, very proud of the work the Neighborhood Development Center has done. You don't need to listen to me, but our bank's been committed to community economic development. We've always gotten an outstanding in Community Reinvestment Act. We've been identified as a great place to work. Part of it is because of the work that Tamale and the Neighborhood Development Center, even though they're split off, enhances our reputation. I appreciate your willingness to consider this legislation. I feel it's important. But the real stars here today are Mike and Michelle and Isaac, and I want to make sure before you adjourn today, you've got time to listen to them. So I think I'll end my remarks at that point.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the members of the committee that don't know, Western Bank, you are one of the stars. And don't diminish your contributions to that neighborhood and to this city. You have been a very strong vision for a visionary business person, and your vision has never been just a handout. It's been a hand up. So thank you so very much.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
So, you going, Isaac?
I'm going, Mr. Right. Chairman.
He was ready.
Members, I'd like to introduce myself, Isaac Carpenter. I'm owner of Initiative Construction, a drywall.
You want to give your name, Isaac, please?
Isaac.
We want to hear it. Know it's there in the archives for 100 years from now.
So. Okay, hopefully I get a recording of this then.
We'll try to do it.
Okay, if you can see to
we
it.
We can handle it.
I'm sure you've got the power. Okay. Isaac Carpenter, owner of Initiative Construction. I'm a drywall contractor here in Minneapolis, St. Paul area. I've met Mike through bidding on the Frogtown Square project, which I'm sure most of you folks have seen if you drove down Dalen University. And as you also know, as a startup company going into a bank without a track record, without an impressive tax returns for the last couple of years, taking on a job of that magnitude is nearly impossible, as long as you can stand getting laughed at or, you know, pretty much the door shut in your face. Well, through Mike, I was able to achieve a loan. I was able to employ up to 22 people for a three-month period on that project. I was able to get not only financing for the project, but I also had weekly meetings with Brian Singer, which helped me for business development, helped me better. I thought I understood cash flow, but as anything between mistakes and mentors, you get to, your eyes are open, as you know. So I've had not only the ongoing education with weekly meetings with them, support anytime I call and ask them. I mean, we just met a few months ago, and these people have been a tremendous help to me. Not only to me, but to my employees, because without them, I would have never been able to take on that job. And especially around Christmas time, New Year in time, it really helped the people with their taxes. So I just want to say I believe in what they're doing. I'm living proof of it. And if I could bring in my crew, they would say the same. So thank you for your time.
Really something, an employer helping an employee with their taxes.
I am. I just want to point out quick that Isaac's company is a union company, so it's a union shop, and they pay union wages. Michelle?
Michelle Geyer, Salty Tart Bakery, and I'm here to talk about my role and NDC's role in fulfilling my dreams as a young entrepreneur who loves to bake. I opened the Salty Tart about 3 years ago with the help of NDC, helping me secure loans, giving me entrepreneurial classes, once again, understanding about cash flow and everything it takes to run a small business. In the 3 years, I've grown to 8 employees, also taking on externs and interns from the culinary world and mentoring them within the hopes of hopefully in the next 6 months opening another small business, which would employ hopefully another 30 or so people, and yet growing again, hopefully with the help of NDC, possibly taking on a food truck, an ice cream truck, and having more employees. So I'm here to living proof of the great work that NDC does and the help that they've given me to fulfill my dream and to be able to bake and work. We bake from scratch every day, which takes lots of employees. We don't open anything from a box. It takes someone to order the food, to scale the food, to make the food, to bake the food, to display it. So it takes a lot of employees to do that every day. And NDC has helped me do that. I'm really proud and happy of that. Thank you.
So thank you, Michelle and Isaac and Bill. If you look at the handout that went around, just a couple things to highlight. First of all, by our latest count, we have about 430 entrepreneurs in business today. On average, they stay in business at least 5 years. So to have that number today also implies that some have been in business in the past and are now closed or have sold. But our cost, according to Wilder Research, which does a major evaluation of our work every 2 years at our expense, our cost per job created is $18,500, and on average they have about 4 jobs each. And so our cost per creating a job is about $4,600. So that's pretty cost effective. We operate 6 business incubators, the global market where Michelle is being one of them. We do a lot of lending. We leverage state money through the Urban Initiative Program out of DEED, but we have a lot of other resources as well for our loan capital. We often partner with banks. In fact, we pretty much, our model is like a ladder where we're trying to get people on a ladder that can move up that ladder and eventually become bankable. And they basically graduate out of our program. They know how to have their financials in order. They have profitability. They know how to present a loan request to a bank, and they can do that, which is why not only Bill's bank, but Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank and plenty of other banks are longtime partners of ours. You see that final bullet on the first page about the taxes paid, $4.6 million. That was as of 2 years ago, and our numbers are up quite a bit since then. But Peter Hegard, a retired Northwest senior banker, does an ROI analysis of different nonprofit organizations, and he concluded that if you just take the taxes paid by our entrepreneurs,
and don't look at anything else, the tax payments that they make annually pay back our programmatic costs at a rate of 65% ROI. So after 1.5 years, 100% of our costs have been paid back, and after that, these ongoing self-sustaining businesses are obviously net contributors to the state. And as I said earlier, to this point, we have really not gotten state funding other than we utilize the DEEDS Urban Initiative Loan Program. We have done some things in Greater Minnesota. We'd like to do more, and the same with some of the suburban communities that have high numbers of lower-income people. We have worked with Latino Economic Development Center down in southwestern rural Minnesota, where there's quite a bit of entrepreneur training and lending going on down there. Now we were involved in helping get that started. So anyway, I just leave it at that, and our hope is that you see how low-income entrepreneurs, if we can access them, if we can find out who they are in any community in the state, have a lot to offer, a lot of talent through this model that we're trying to share all over the state. We've figured out how to access those folks, how to train those folks, gain their trust enough to train them, and then to finance them. And in so doing, have created over 2,000 jobs at the cost of about $4,600 a job. And we would like you to consider supporting this work with $200,000 of state funding. Although I understand this isn't a great year to be sitting here asking for that, but yeah, we've been doing it for 18 years. This is the first time we actually came forth to ask for that. So, anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation, Representative Mahoney. Mulry, excuse me. He can pay you later.
Mr. Chairman, you could be sued for defaming me that way. Mr. Sands, I know that you, your bank for decades has been the one that financed businesses in that area, and right across the street from it was the Faust. Did you finance that business?
Do you remember those days? They were fun.
And for Mike, it's a great bakery you put in there, but for 14 years I've been an unpaid lobbyist for you, and you go and stick a great bakery down there and still haven't delivered for my north half of North Minneapolis, except for finally this year we got a laundry. Yep. From you, but for all unpaid lobbying you've gotten all over the Twin Cities from me, I think it's about time that you start delivering for the Camden community of Minneapolis. Everybody knows, I think you do a great job, and I really hate to say that, because when I started trying to get him into Minneapolis, he was totally St. Paul, and we don't usually like to say that things from there are better. But
I'm just glad they don't finance law offices. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too want to recognize you for your incredible work and creativity, and just the creating businesses with small micro business loans. We know this works in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, excuse me, with entrepreneurs, small entrepreneurs. It's great to have it happening right here in our own state, and we do. For the benefit of other members of this committee, we do fund a number of very good organizations that do this kind of work. We haven't funded these folks yet, and I think it could be a very great opportunity. And so I wanted to just give you a chance to say what you might do with, if you thought about what you might do with those dollars.
Sure. Yes. First of all, I do want to mention to our Representative Mullery that Isaac is from North Minneapolis, and in fact we've trained about 180 entrepreneurs from Northside in the last 3 years and financed about 35 business startups up there, so I'll get you the data. But Camden, maybe a little far north, maybe it's we're
not
around
Mullery.
West. We're yeah
I'm a Camden resident.
You're a Camden resident, right there.
I knew he didn't know his constituents.
Representative Clark's question, if we could get a little bit of state funding, I mean, what's different about our work from some of the other organizations that do get state funding is that we're very neighborhood specific and ethnic specific. So we do our training out in these different communities. We do it in their language. We try to keep entrepreneurs keeping their business in their own neighborhood. So it's very much about concentrating these entrepreneurs and building up the neighborhood through that concentration. Number one, we'd be able to continue the work we've been doing at the pace we have been, but number two, we'd expand it, because even though we're in a down economy and unemployment is high, there's actually an inverse relationship with our work, because as people get laid off, they come to us looking to start a business. So the demand for our service is way up, just in our own targeted neighborhoods of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we could accommodate more of that demand. But third and finally, we get a lot of requests from greater Minnesota and from some particular suburbs to bring our model to those locations also. And like I said earlier, we've done a little bit of that. We would do more of that if we could get this extra funding.
Thank you.
Representative Leidiger first, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Representative Clark asked the question, so I just want to congratulate Isaac and Michelle for what you're doing and your employers. There are about, I think, over half of the committee over here own businesses, and we understand how difficult it is. So keep going. Keep going. Let's spread the word.
Michelle, do you deliver?
In Fairmont?
For a price.
I'm glad you're learning how to cash flow works.
Great response.
Representative Swinski.
Yes. Chair, my question is, Representative Clark mentioned a little bit about some of these microloans that are kind of going on. How do you guys compare yourselves to some of these things we hear about in the news and international type things, and your successes, and do you have some numbers as far as your successes there compared to some of those other things?
You know, in 1992, Bill Sands and Western Bank paid for me to go, Governor Arne Carlson was in office, to on a trade mission to Thailand and Indonesia. My purpose for that was to learn about sort of international microfinance models, and then bring that back home and see if there's some way to apply that in our neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of differences. They typically charge 25 to 35% interest annually. Our interest rate, the highest it ever was 10%. We're more like at 5.5% right now. They've been in the news in a negative light in India recently. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, for pretty extraordinary collection procedures that have gotten some negative publicity. We don't have too many large bald guys that are out collecting. Although we do collect, we take collateral, and we will. Our whole model is to keep working with everybody that's in business through our program, as long as they keep working with us and as long as they keep working on their business. In other words, we will we don't foreclose on them after 30 day late or 60 day late. If they're in communication with our technical assistants and loan officers, if they're working on improving their business, which most of them, that's what they live for, we'll keep working with them, and often we'll restructure their loan. And often even consider a second loan if they've learned through the first 6 or 12 months how to really make a buck and improve their business. We often will get involved with them, both providing technical assistance and legal assistance, marketing assistance, et cetera, but also maybe a second loan. Does that answer your question?
Why don't you talk about your delinquencies and charge-offs? Do you have those figures?
Yeah,
we can get those at another time.
No, I mean we write off 8% of our loans.
I'm sure 92%. A lot of organizations like yours do that. It's one of the unpleasant but necessary things.
Yeah.
And we're running short of time, but I want to thank you all for coming. And
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mulry,
I know he very wants to adjourn, but I have to clarify something. Mr. Tamale said he was coming to this committee because he hadn't gotten money from the committee before. I remember I carried the bill, and Mr. Chairman, you were the first co-author on the bill, and this committee did fund them, but it was vetoed by Governor Carlson.
Governor Carlson, okay. Anyway, we tried once, and we'll work on it again, I'm sure. One of the things you have to do is produce a bill to do that, so I'm sure you will be counseled into doing that. And looks like you have several willing authors. And I also want to make an announcement. The committee, we started a new policy. Representative Scalzi said that anybody that has a bill here has to provide cookies, but we've had cookies already today, and they were very delicious.
No, you said the rookies.
The rookie. Okay. So, rookie, bring cookies on Tuesday.
Rookies, bring cookies.
You're going to bring
Mr. Chairman, we know where to get
Thank
the cookies.
We're adjourned.